Hello and welcome to Louder Than Words, the pod that's all about ideas that improve lives. I'm Jules Pretty. In this episode, we're talking about babies. Our early years in life, how mothers and babies interact, what sets us up for a good life. I'm delighted to welcome three guests from the University of Essex, Sylvia Rigato and Maria Filippetti from the Department of Psychology, who set up and run the Baby Lab, and Joe Barton from the School of Sport, Rehabilitation and Exercise Sciences, who's worked with young people in natural places. Thanks so much for coming on the pod. Let's start with a big question then. So much has changed this century over technologies, communications, economic inequality, access to nature, food and diet. How do things look for mothers and babies in the 2020s? You've just had a baby yourself, Sylvia. Tell us a bit about the Baby Lab and a little bit about these kind of bigger questions of what it's like.
Okay, so the Baby Lab is a lab in the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. And we study how babies develop from basically birth and even some studies on prenatal development, so with pregnant women, and mainly up to the first couple of years of life. That's because we know that this is a critical time for babies' development. To understand how then we actually grow up into the adults that we are. So there is a lot going on in terms of big changes. Obviously, we know that, you know, when babies are born, you know, they can't just do much for us to understand. But really, what we can see with studies at the Baby Lab is that they are quite able to communicate with us. They can look around, and just by understand what they look and what they prefer to look at, we understand lots about what they do. So this is what we do at the Baby Lab. We really study how they develop since the beginning of life.
Fantastic. That's great. Well, tell us a bit about those kind of early days. We hear a lot about the first 1,000 days of life overall. What are the lessons that we learn from working closely with mothers and babies, Maria, particularly during those kind of those early years?
Yeah, that's a really tough question, because on one hand, I think the short answer is that we can learn a lot. As Sylvia said, those early years are critical. There's so much growth that goes on, and indeed, there's more growth than at any other stage of development. And babies are especially good at picking up information. They are intrinsically motivated to learn. And one of the things that is remarkable is that there are studies showing that the childlike, playful attitude to learning is really important for babies to actually learn new skills. So it's at the core of how is their core approach of learning. And this flexibility we tend to lose as we grow. We learn things, we learn from experience, and we use those, you know, this information, this experience to drive our learning. So we get a bit stuck into rules, and that's really, it's not really good for learning in the end. So there are studies that actually show that adults that are driven to follow more of a childlike, playful attitude to learn, they learn better, they show more flexibility, and they improve. So maybe we can learn something about that. They're using more of a childlike attitude, playful attitude to learning can help in those late years of life.
Yeah, fantastic. That's really interesting. And you've talked a lot about the importance of fun in the Baby Lab. We'll come to that in a moment. Joe, you've worked with older children than babies, particularly in natural places. And one of the interesting things when thinking about the early years of life, and I think you would emphasize this, Maria and Sylvia, in your work, is that there's always the opportunity to change. We're not fixed by what happens early on. There are really important occasions. But you've worked a lot with children and older people right the way up in natural places. What sorts of kind of things have you observed about the changes that people can undergo actually quite quickly, as Maria was saying there?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've been very fortunate to have the opportunity to work with young adolescents, particularly youth at risk, and how local charities use wilderness experiences to change their behaviour. And just being put in that position outside that therapeutic environment gives them an opportunity for reflection away from their chaotic lives to really think about their behavioural choices. And that environment, that nature setting, affords that sort of behaviour. So we see big improvements in behavioural outcomes over a longer term that's sustained. They re-enter education, they go on to get jobs. So really life-changing events that all stem from that initial wilderness experience. Mm.
So whatever happens in the early years, the early days, is really important. And yet we also know that later on we can use some of those lessons about how babies learn and how mothers interact with babies and apply them to possible changes later in life. Well, you talk quite a lot about the importance of fun in the baby lab, Sylvia, calling some of the babies and children little scientists, which is lovely, actually, as a kind of something about the kind of way that we can engage with people and learn from their engagements with children, and a perfect intervention there from your daughter. That's lovely. Could you just tell us a little bit about that kind of that importance of fun, but also the learning that the mothers that you work with also get from engaging with the baby lab?
Yeah, of course. So as you said, you know, they are these babies, we think of them as little scientists. And that's because, as Maria Laura was saying, they are really curious about the environment. So what they do is really testing what's happening around them and how things work. So, you know, if you are a parent, you know, for example, that how babies like to drop things continuously from, you know, the high chair, for example, to the floor, and you continuously pick them up. So they are testing gravity, really, are they? So, you know, this is how we feel about them. Here we go. A little more than a little intervention here. And so for us, it is really important to understand what they are doing and, you know, try not to, as a parent, try not to be annoyed by the fact that they test and retest, because that's real science. And we, you know, like to invite all the parents to really observe their own babies and, you know, understand what they're actually doing. So observe, you know, your personal individual baby rather than read on books what's going on, how development should happen, and just understand how your baby is individually developing with time. And so, through observation, it's really the key to have fun and to, you know, try to laugh with your baby and, you know,
perfect
have a little bit
again.
Of patience here and there.
Lovely. That's great. So there's something about kind of attentiveness here, isn't there? Sort of you're also, if I could put the word in your mouth, you're also teaching the mothers, the parents to be attentive to what the babies are doing and learning something from that context. So you're learning something by observing this, but by putting mothers and their children within the baby lab context, is it right to say that they're learning something from being more attentive, as Sylvia was saying there, to watching what is happening and thinking about those interactions in a way that we might just be responsive and not thinking, and perhaps then more annoyed when somebody cries or when something happens? But if you think of it as part of a kind of life learning experience, perhaps we see it differently. Is that something you've observed?
I think that's absolutely right. So this is one of the core approach, really, that we've been working on with Sylvia over the past years. We have established a multidisciplinary group that focuses on child development. And we gathered, you know, experts on child development from practitioners, midwives, and professionals that focus on prenatal and postnatal development. And one of the core approach here is that really parental responsiveness, so our attention to the babies, is at the forefront. And this is because by looking at how they interact, as Sylvia said, what they do and how they observe the environment and how they look at the consequences of their actions. So understanding, if I do something, that will cause an effect. And let me try that again and see if it works. So they learn rules and they learn predictabilities, the how things really, you know, how regularities in the environment. And the what we do from our perspective is to put the science into the right context. So explain the reasons why they do what they do. And by doing so, you change that perspective, that old adult-centric perspective into a baby-centric perspective to really bridge a gap. So we tend as adults to expect that babies adjust to our own expectations, but we don't understand that by taking their own approach, by taking their, you know, reference frame, we can gain a broader understanding of what's happening.
Very interesting. That, so we're turning around a little bit and,
yeah, exactly,
you know, putting the babies more at the centre of things and understanding how things are for them. Well, could I come to something that a kind of contemporary change that we all have experienced, most of the people now across the world, is over mobile phones and communication. And something that we couldn't have imagined happening 15 years ago, perhaps even 10 years ago, and how the attentiveness to others around us, we might use that in the broadest sense, changes when we've got this opportunity to be communicating on a small device. So, Joe, just let's jump to the kind of wilderness experiences you were talking about earlier on, and what happens when, I think it's right to say, you would be giving instructions about putting mobile phones in a box and leaving them to one side, and then what happens to young people when that's taken away. And then perhaps I can come back to Maria and Silvia and say, so what, you know, in your context, how are you seeing mothers' engagements or parents' engagements with mobile communications that might actually sit literally physically between them and the baby? And that's going to be something that I'm sure you've thought a lot about. Joe, first of all.
Yeah, I think that's a powerful memory, actually. Back in 2007, when I first got involved in the research, that, yes, at the beginning of the wilderness experience, one of the key points was getting all the young people to come together to actually part with their mobile phones. Now, this was quite a horrific experience, and I'm not exaggerating here, for these young people, because they are attached to these phones 24/7. And we actually made it into ceremonial occasion and got them all to put their devices in a box to say goodbye, and they would get them back in 5 days' time when they returned from the wilderness experience. It was quite emotional for these children to part with these devices. But interestingly, I would say within half an hour, it was so quick, all conversation about mobile devices, how they were going to cope, completely gone. Once you're immersed in that wilderness environment, everything that's happened previously has moved on. So I was amazed at how quickly they recovered from this separation from the item that meant the most to them.
And so do you think that contributed to more talking to each other, more attentiveness to other people? Because we could have attentiveness to nature, but if we're talking about particularly mother-baby relationships here, attentiveness to others around us is going to be an important determinant of what happens later in life.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, managing to encourage a young person to extract themselves from the phone just opens up a whole new world of being attentive to everything that's around them, to other people, engaging in conversation, noticing the world around them. You know, it's a real game changer. So I'm a big advocate for changing screen time to green time. Mm. This is the way forward, definitely.
Great. Well, I don't want to give the impression that we're for or against mobile phones, but it's just the positioning of technology within our lives that is a kind of intriguing one, particularly in these early years. Silvia, could you say a little bit about your kind of observations then about technology in this space between the relationship between parents and small babies? How has that changed over time? What have you learned from that? And what might you tell, actually, Maria, you could come to this, what might you tell mothers from what you've learned about this in due course?
Okay, so parental phone use is quite an emerging field, you know, now in psychology. And there are some studies that, you know, still to be, you know, further explored and investigated. But so far what has been suggested is that parents are, as you said, a little bit distracted by the use of their phones. And this is actually something that researchers have found also at the very beginning of a newborn life. You know, for example, when moms are breastfeeding or just feeding, you know, bottle feeding, sometimes they are distracted with their phone. And this is actually an important time that they have with their babies, because they might lose some signals that the baby is giving to them, like, you know, that's enough, you know, my tummy is full. So what studies are suggesting that is that parents are losing a little bit their ability to respond to the cues that the babies are giving at that particular time.
So is that a worry then, Maria? Or is that kind of just an observation about actually how things are changing and we're going to start to respond to that? Again, might you find yourself saying to mothers, well, look, this is one of the consequences. You're going to miss some of these cues that Sylvia was telling us about.
Yeah, I think as Sylvia said, it's definitely something emerging from the research. We still know very little about the long-term effects, but I suppose it's like with everything that, you know, emerges in, like, you know, technology-wise. TVs, when they first came out, were a big worry about, you know, the fact that you lose the opportunities for communication with your family members if you stare in front of a TV for a long time. And I suppose, like for everything, it's about optimal mid-range, isn't it? So finding that balance. With the technology use, as Sylvia said, there's a lot of interference. And that's what in the field is called the technoference. So there's a disruption in the interaction that prevents you from engaging with someone. But at the same time, you can use that smartphone to engage and interact together. And that's the same, you know, with tablets or any device, really. So it's about the use that you make of it. And I suppose, yes, there's a worry about, you know, the use that we make, but at the same time, we can communicate that depending on how you engage with things, you can use those as opportunities for, you know, learning more about your child, for example. But obviously, we need to develop tools that facilitate that, I think.
It's interesting. Some years ago, I remember, and I remember being completely intrigued by this, and then not sure what I thought about it. Somebody telling me that her granddaughter, and this doesn't work well on a podcast. It's a good visual thing. Had been using a mobile device, a larger than a phone device, one where you open your fingers to change the scale, and the child was opening up her fingers on the real world to try to change the focus on what was happening in the real world. And you saw this. And I remember thinking, gosh, isn't that intriguing? And then thinking, oh, I'm not sure if I think that's a worry or not, because that's a completely new kind of reaction to the world. It might be that that engagement actually increases our looking outwards and engagement with the world. It might not be a problem at all, but it's certainly kind of changing things, isn't it? We're a couple of years nearly into lockdowns and pandemics. Maria, you have a particularly personal experience of a lockdown baby during this period. What have we learnt about what's been happening to all of us over the last couple of years, and particularly mothers and babies? You've continued in the Baby Lab with your engagement with mothers who are working with you, and that you're teaching to become scientists and little scientists and so forth. But what would be your observations about this kind of recent period, and what has it told us about the importance of the early years in life? But also, what are your observations about this period in general as well?
So yeah, as you said, there's a bit of a personal attachment to this, because obviously I had a baby during the first lockdown, and that was definitely not what I was expecting. So it certainly had an impact on how I approach my research, and I suppose I was very worried about the consequences of that. And at the same time, I know, you know, from the many books and research I've read, that I shouldn't have been worried. But obviously, when you get the personal attachment, things take a completely different perspective. So what we did, we tried to make use of that time to engage more with families. And through the group that I mentioned earlier, with other practitioners and professionals, we tried and organize online, obviously, events and interventions where we were just talking about different topics, different themes that could be of interest to families, from sleep and how that could have changed during lockdown, sleep patterns in babies and toddlers, to the impact of, being indoors for so long with a small baby, the impact on mental health. And Sylvia is an expert on the topic. She's been doing a lot of research on prenatal and postnatal mood changes. We did run also a study on prenatal mental health during COVID in pregnant women. We tried to make, the most out of it and gain as much information as we could. And one of the things that I think was a big worry among mums was whether these very young babies would have, be affected by this sudden change in life. However, if we think about that again, by taking a baby, centric perspective, they don't know any better. So they would have noticed any difference. And if anything, what we know from a history of research on the topic is that, especially during the first month of life, babies are especially interested and tuned towards parents and their caregivers. They look at faces, they are interested in their voices, they seek contact. And that's what we could do, if anything, that we had so much time for that.
We maybe had more of that.
Exactly. And so going back to that parental responsiveness, we had a unique opportunity to tune into our baby's needs, learn about them, learn about these emerging personalities, and really establish that strong bond. Obviously, we're not dismissing the consequences and how they affected us and in this life-changing time, but from a baby perspective, we had an opportunity that probably we would have never had.
Very interesting. Sylvia, do you want to add to that then? Maria was saying, expertise and knowledge about changes in mood before and after birth, and then what's been happening during this period in lockdown, some goods alongside the big challenges that we've all faced.
Yeah, sure. So what we know is that both prenatal and postnatal maternal mental health, such as, depression or anxiety, they are associated, unfortunately, with some long-term negative effects on the mother, because that can last, for a long time, as well as on the child. This can start very early, like neonatal outcome, but also last into, for example, the adolescent years. What we also know from studies is that there is quite a percentage, unfortunately, of mothers feeling these symptoms during pregnancy and after. But also, and for us really importantly, there are also mothers who have subclinical symptoms. So that means that practitioners often miss the opportunity to help her. And this percentage of mothers can be quite high in different studies. They've been found being between 30 and 40% of mothers. So it's quite a number of mothers that can go undetected. So our studies, in fact, actually focus on the general population. And what we find is that even these subclinical symptoms can actually affect how babies develop. And what we are finding with the study that we did during the COVID is that this percentage is even higher. However, the good news is that we also found that this effect of feeling low is actually buffered when there is social support. So if there is a good support from family, partner, as well as the healthcare system, then, everything can go better. And this is really good because it has an effect on the mothers during pregnancy, but also we know that we'll have a good effect on the baby as well when he comes out.
Very interesting. So, to a certain extent, we've kind of simplified in this kind of complexity of early life into a number of things that are really important. Perhaps I could I'll come back to you in a moment to say, well, what would be, let's turn this around to make some recommendations to listeners about what we should be focusing on as parents, as supporters, as Sylvia was saying, the wider social context is kind of really important to this. But you've also said, first of all, the body is a source of social information. And that sort of is an intriguing thought, that what happens to us tells us, not just about our own body, our own way of living, the genes inside us and the mechanisms, but it tells us about the social context in which we're living. So what sorts of things have we picked up? And I wonder whether we can align that into then thinking about, again, Joe, how we kind of intervene in to help people who might have suffered, say, particularly traumas in early life, and what can be done as direct intervention. So what are your thoughts about this the body is a source of social information, Maria?
Well, we do run a lot of studies around how babies learn about bodies and their own bodies. So this is a shared interest that Sylvia and I have, and we've been researching separately and now together into these topics. And we discovered that to learn about their bodies, babies use information that they derive from different senses. So they, for example, integrate and bind together vision and touch and what they hear and what they smell to learn about themselves. So obviously, our senses give us a reference frame. It's me that, you know, is staring at my hand moving, and I can see my hand moving at the same time as I move it. So that's already an integration of different information. And we found, for example, that they use vision to localize a touch on their hands, and that they are more interested in watching from day one a face that is touched at the same time as they feel a touch on their own face. So again, they show an interest, we could call it an inbuilt or innate interest for this source of information that tells them something about themselves. But obviously, whenever we talk about bodies, we talk also about the interactions that we have with our bodies. One of the emerging lines of research that I'm particularly focused on is how these interactions help children learn about the distinction and the boundaries between themselves and others. And obviously, having a strong reference frame might help towards interacting better with others or engaging in interactions. And again, we go back to these early years, because how do we learn about these boundaries is through caregiver-infant interactions. We learned about what we need and how to communicate that so that someone can help us to fulfill those needs. And that gives us information about what is hunger compared to pain. So how caregivers respond to these signals teaches us about our own bodies. Mm. And this is inherently interactive in nature, because we are so dependent on our caregivers at the very beginning that we wouldn't survive without that.
So it kind of suggests as well that that what seems to be a hard border when you look at our bodies or babies' bodies is actually much more diffuse, because we've got interactions flowing backwards and forwards. You've got attentiveness to other people, to the environment around them, mm-hmm. and a kind of extended body in a sense, because the social context around that, the family, the caregivers, the wider environment, is going to be a critical part of the success for whole life.
Absolutely.
So if we turn this then to thinking about what we think should happen in early years, and what that can lead to for a kind of healthy and long life. Joe, when you're working with all sorts of different people, particularly in kind of natural places, and you're looking back at where they've come from, some of them suffered considerable traumas in life. What sorts of things are you seeing that would make you think, if I could wind the clock back, what I would want to do for these children? Is it around physical activity? Is it diet? Is it social context? Is it inequality? It might be all of those things, but to say it's everything is to say, well, it's the fault of the whole world, which might be true. But where would you be wanting to kind of intervene? What would be your top three things?
Well, I think I might be considered to be biased here because of my research focus. But I think that giving them the opportunity to spend time outdoors in nature actually is a great approach to tick all of those boxes, because it enables you to be more active. We know the research shows that if you spend time outdoors as a child, you're more physically active. It encourages social interaction. So you actually open up those opportunities for more social support. You're engaging in activities with other members of the family, so it's multi-generational. So that environment and those opportunities will tick a lot of those boxes. And if we can provide opportunities for children to learn about how to grow vegetables, for example, this can not only teach them responsibility, because they've got to remember to water the plants, water the vegetables, see them grow, but actually it might then influence their dietary choices, which all feeds into a much more positive living that, you know, will hopefully feed into adulthood, because a lot of the activities and behaviours that happen as a child do track into adulthood. So it's quite important to have those opportunities early as possible.
And thanks for that. So Sylvia, and going back then a little bit earlier, in the very early days, months and years, the baby's looking inward, looking at faces of mothers and caregivers, and that's the kind of the starting point is the closer, and then we start to kind of go outwards, don't we, as you were just describing. What would you say would be the top three things that you would be recommending to people on the back of what we understand about these interactions and these relationships, if somebody were to ask for advice? So we're turning this around now. What would you say, top three, this is what should be happening, given the amazing complexity of each of our lives and the social and cultural lives and how different they all are anyway. But even despite that, cut through it and tell us about your top three.
I would say for parents, then a little bit to go back to what we said earlier, to have fun with their babies and children. So observe them, learn from them, as Maria Laura was suggesting about curiosity. So observe, learn from them, have fun. And I would say, you know, in general, to maybe the society in that sense, or healthcare and the family support, like I would say that motherhood, you know, is needs to be like a social responsibility, so that it's not only mothers that need to face these vulnerable times of, you know, going through pregnancy and the early years, but it's the whole world around them. So try to really develop a shared sense of parenthood, really. Did I miss any other?
Perfect.
How many did I say? I don't
that's
know.
Right. That's okay. That'll do. Maria, what would you say then? We'll finish off with your kind of three-ish observations.
Yeah. So I think, Joe and Sylvia said it all, and I wholly agree with what they said. And I think, yeah, it really is about tuning into your child and thinking about your baby as a growing human being that has an emerging personality, that is learning about new things, and if anything, try and take that approach. So I think really shifting that perspective and trying to remember and observe through their eyes how it feels like to discover new things every day. There's so much to learn from them. And one of the things that I realized is the strong commitment to learn that the infants have. They need to learn to walk. They need to learn to talk. Otherwise, they wouldn't survive. It's not just a hobby. Like, you know, I could pick up any random hobby and give up after a couple of failures. So that failure and learning and just stubbornly going ahead no matter what is really something to learn from. And I think that's it, switching the perspective and taking a childlike approach to life.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much indeed. Sylvia Rigato and Maria Filippetti, Joe Barton from the University of Essex, and the fourth participant, as you will have heard in the background, Sylvia's two-month-old daughter. I think that's the first time on the pod that we've had such a young participant. Thank you so much for coming in on the conversation there. We wish you well. Thanks very much indeed, everybody. Been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Louder Than Words. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. Have a look at the website for more information, and do rate the pod if you can.